Well, welcome to this afternoon's book discussion. Today we are going to be talking about The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell. I need someone to volunteer to be a recorder as we kick off our little our session this afternoon. Thank you, Sarah. What I would like you to share with the group today is your first name and the name of the book that you plan to read next. Okay? So my name is Jan, and the book that I plan to read next is Shantaram.
Oh boy.
Anybody read that?
How do you spell it?
S-H-A-N-T-A-R-A-M. And I don't remember the author, but it's a big, thick one. Okay, who's ready to go next?
I plan to read a book called Fields of Compassion.
Fields of Compassion.
Author,
and you are Sue?
Susan. Yeah.
Susan. Fields of Compassion.
Carlos. I'm going to read The Brothers Cain again.
Okay, for a second time?
David James Duncan.
Carl, was that the name? Carl?
Carlos.
Carlos.
The Brothers Cain. Okay, Kathleen. Are you ready to go with the book you're going to read next?
Kathleen, I'm going to read Conversations with God.
Okay.
And Karen, and I finished The Sparrow this morning, and I would like to start Children of God sequel.
This afternoon.
I was in the middle of a book when I started reading Sparrow, so I'll finish that
one. Okay, but it's on your list. Very good. Dave?
Does it have to be fiction?
No.
Oh, so my next book, I've already decided, because I have it on my list, is called Theresienstadt. It's about the concentration camp.
Okay.
Yeah, give me
a name. Oh, David. My name is David.
And how to spell the name of the book, please? Thank you.
All right. And we'll go on to Kristen.
Kristen. And I don't know. I just got two things finished here this week, so...
You're open to suggestions.
I guess. I really don't know what I'm going to... I've got something else going on at home that I need to finish up, but I don't know what I'm going to read next.
Okay.
I had lots of suggestions this week, so that's good.
Okay. So we'll leave that as a blank.
Yeah. Glenn, and also a nonfiction book we're reading. You Lost Me.
You Lost Me?
You Lost Me, yeah.
And the book study. Let's see, we'll go back here to Norma.
I was really impressed with the book you did yesterday.
Cutting for Stone.
Yeah. And so I have an asterisk so that I can pick that up.
You can move that up to the top of the list. Okay, very good. Molly?
Molly, probably Silent Night, just from the synopsis Norma gave.
Okay, good. And that's what we're going to be discussing tomorrow, Simon's Night by John Hassler. If you haven't read it, I would still invite you to come. It's a quick read and delightful in my book.
Corinne, the piano teacher.
Oh, I like that one very much. The piano teacher. Okay. Let's see.
Who's going to read Piano Teacher?
Corinne. Corinne.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So we will come back to you, Barbara, and how about you? And what are you reading? Your name and?
Catherine Abel Emerging.
Abel Emerging.
Oh.
Oh. And I was thinking A-B-L-E. Abel Emerging.
Yeah. Did I get it right?
Abel. No, it's like in the Bible, but Abel. Okay. That guy. Cain and. Okay, Paul?
I'm Paul, and I'm going to read a nonfiction book called Alone Together that's an assessment of the impact of technology on our lives, and particularly the next generation.
Together.
Alone together.
Alone together.
That's abbreviated. Together. Knitters know that. Yeah.
Ron, I just bought a book in the bookstore, Jesus Freak by Sarah Miles.
Jesus what?
Freak.
Freak?
Jesus Freak.
Freak. Freak.
Get your freak
two
on.
Two words?
Two words, I believe.
Nancy?
I'm halfway through The Sparrow, actually for the second time. So I'm going to finish that, and then I have another one to finish called Birds of a Feather. It's a detective novel of London in between the World Wars.
Oh, good.
Who wrote it?
Okay, and Marilyn, do you have a book you're going to read next?
Yes, actually, our church has started doing, you know, summer reads, mm-hmm. and then we do a book discussion in September. So the book that they chose was Unbroken.
Ah.
It's a World War II book. It's kind of depressing as you start reading it, you know, all the time. But when that's done, I love Jodi Picoult's books.
Oh,
yeah. And The Plain Truth and Amish Stories.
Yes.
Is that her newest one?
Not
okay. Okay, well, did we get everybody? Oh, no, we need Barbara.
This is what we're going to read?
Yeah, what you're going to read next.
Some Assembly Required by
Anne Lamott
and Sam.
All right, very good. Thank you, Some Assembly Required. Sarah, did we get yours?
No. I'm in a young adult book club,
mm-hmm.
and the week I get back, they meet, so whatever that title is, I'll pick it up at the store and read it.
Excellent, excellent.
So it's a young adult book club.
So how many of you, I don't usually start out this way, but how many of you have read The Sparrow? Okay. For those of you that have not finished it, I'm going to try really hard not to spoil it for you, but there's some pretty big things that we're going to have to talk around pretty carefully, or you're just going to have to not listen, try not to remember the part that's going to, because I don't quite know how we can talk about it without kind of revealing some of the details. I also don't usually start out this way, but if you were going to say one word that would describe your experience reading The Sparrow, what would that word be?
Mesmerizing.
Spiritual.
Horizons.
Horizons?
Uh-huh, spiritual horizons broadening out.
Mm-hmm. His eyes on the sparrow. Mm-hmm. Frightening.
Strange.
Strange.
Disoriented.
Yeah.
It's more than one word, but red flags. Things happening, I'm like, no, 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 you shouldn't do that.
Don't do that, yeah.
I'm thinking Prime Directive from Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Original. I think it's one of the most original novels I've ever read. I don't read a lot of science fiction or fantasy. And it is science fiction, but it's not strictly science fiction either, I don't think. But absolutely original. So just to help you review, if it's been a while, our main characters, those that go on the voyage, are Emilio. He sounds like a heartthrob. You know, an incredibly good-looking Hispanic priest. Sophia, an incredibly good-looking woman who is brilliant. Anne and George, who are also very memorable, an older couple. She's a physician and anthropologist. George can do anything, basically. Jimmy, the very, very tall man who first hears the music from outer space. Mark, who is French, and another priest, who is a Jesuit, who is on this expedition. Alan, who I don't remember very much about except that he was the musician, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of the musical expert. And then D.W., who was the highest-ranking Jesuit on the... But, you know, kind of went against all stereotypes, like to curse, like to speak in a Texas accent, like to, you know, was really a fun character to listen to. So, you know, the first quarter of the book is just kind of the introduction of all of these characters, which... I think she does a really nice job of sort of weaving together. She brings all these really disparate people together from all over the world and kind of makes us care about them from a really, really early point. Then what happens? What happens that makes this all fall apart? What happens that makes everything sort of come together? There's something that happens that makes people think we're not alone here. Anybody remember? Jimmy? Is that a big dish? Satellite dish?
I'm
there real early. Really early.
I was already on the planet.
Oh, no, we're not there. Before we go to the planet, what happens? What happens?
He hears music.
Yeah.
And he's able to figure out that
it's not some weird noises going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually.
It's interplanetary, yeah.
And he treats it as music as a hunch. It's like, almost would have missed it, except that he happened to be thinking about music at the time and thought, well, let's run this through the audio system and see what comes out.
Yeah. So who does he call but some of his friends, right? He's friends with Emilio, Anne, and George. They kind of come there. They kind of keep it a secret. And how do you suppose it is ultimately then that the Society of Jesus or the Jesuits take on this mission to go to another planet? How is it that, you know, wouldn't NASA be in charge of something like this normally?
But it was what they'd done in ancient times, was that they would send missionaries. They would send people out to
And with the Jesuits, the decision could be made very quickly, because that was their identity to go where there are people.
They were evangelical.
On the science fiction part of the story, space travel was all privatized. Mm-hmm. So there is no NASA anymore. It's all by corporations. And so the thought of going into space without government involvement is much easier to think about that.
Well, which has sort of happened since the book was published, right? You know, Richard Branson is, you know, working on a trip to the moon, and there's a private citizen that's been an astronaut. I mean, that's not as science fiction-y as it was even 15 years ago. But yeah, the Jesuits, that's their identity. They're going to be, you know, they've always sent missionaries. They're going to make contact with other civilizations. So it does happen relatively quickly that they're able to do this private mission to this this far-off planet. Let's talk, anybody want to do a little reading for me today about them landing? And I can't remember what they called the planet.
Rakat.
Anybody want to do?
I don't necessarily want to read.
No, okay.
But it seems the other thing that needs to be said about this book that's so intriguing is that it's called backwards and forwards at the same time.
Yeah, good point.
So that you know from the very beginning that the mission has failed, and there is a survivor in Naples who's in bad shape, and you don't know what he's recovering from.
Right.
Or if he will recover, or if he will speak when he recovers, all of that's up for grabs. And then the second chapter is the Jimmy.
Yeah, very good point. So it kind of goes back and forth. Did anybody have trouble with that, or did you find that kind of a useful technique to kind of know the outcome from the beginning? It kind of pulled me through, I think.
Yeah. Well, I found myself very curious, because you knew there was something with his hands, and it was very slow to kind of unfold what had happened to his hands.
I'm just curious if anybody else had the experience. I love the Naples chapters, and I had to kind of force myself through the expedition chapters.
Oh.
I was, you know, I didn't dare skip them because every chapter gave you some data. But I just love that, you know, that I could savor the remembering, but the plotting forward. Nobody else had that reaction? Oh, right.
And that's okay. Well, and those sections were, I mean, I think those sections you could picture like in a movie. You know, they're out on a boat, or they're standing by the water, or they're eating, you know. I mean, you could sort of picture that. The part where they do the landing, which I'm going to assign David to read, it gives a description of a place that we've never been, or we don't have any sort of framework for understanding. I'm sorry if I'm making you get out another pair of glasses. That is totally not fair.
Well, to follow what Paul said, when I was reading those, the ones that are set in Kashan and then the other places on the planet, it was like reading a Greek tragedy or something, because I knew from the other part that they're all dead, except for Emilio. And so it's like waiting, how is it going to happen? And then it was interesting that it was always a surprise. You know, I didn't really foresee it happening, this character in that way.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because you know it's terrible, and you have this kind of feeling of dread throughout the whole novel, but you don't know why it's terrible. So if you would please read the section where they have landed on Rakat.
Between the brackets?
Please.
Okay. There followed days of rapture and hilarity. Children on a field trip to Eden, they named everything they saw. The eat-me's and the elephant birds, hoppers and walkies, the all-black Jesuits and the all-brown Franciscans, scummies and crawlers, hose noses and squirrel tails, little green guys, bluebacks and flower faces, and Richard Nixon's, which walked bent over looking for food. And then black and white Dominicans to round out their collection of orders, and turtle trees, whose seed pods resembled turtle shells, peanut bushes, whose brown blossoms were double-lobed, baby's feet with foliage soft as rose petals, and pig plants, whose leaves were like sow's ears. The niches were all there, air to fly through, water to swim in, soil to burrow under, vegetation to exploit and hide behind. The principles were the same. Form follows function. Reach high for sunlight. Strut your stuff to attract a mate. Scatter lots of offspring or take good care of a precious few. Warn predators that you're poisonous with bright colors or blend into the background to escape detection. But the sheer beauty and ingenuity of the animal adaptations were breathtaking, and the gorgeousness of the plant life staggering. Anne and Mark, their eyes informed by their study of evolution and Darwinian selection, were beside themselves with delight in everything they saw. They said it with different inflections, but they both exclaimed repeatedly, "My God, this is so great." And long past the point when the others wanted to drop exhausted to the ground, Anne's voice or Mark's could be heard calling softly but urgently, "You've got to see this. Come quick before it moves," until they were all sated with beauty and novelty and astonishment. D.W. had come in over ocean and flown low as a drug smuggler over what might as well be called treetops. He spotted a clearing and made a snap decision to land there rather than further on in the plain Mark had chosen. Surrounded by the tall, heavy-stemmed vegetation that filled the niche of trees, they felt safe and unobserved. If the weather promised to be mild, they slept in the open, weaponless, too ignorant or trusting to worry about major carnivores or aggressive, poisonous things. They had tents and took shelter during the sudden rainstorms, but they were frequently drenched. No one cared. The nights were so brief and the days so warm, they dried out quickly and napped in the leaf-filtered sunlight, drowsing in the warmth, contented and lazy as dogs by firelight. Even dozing, they were suffused with their surroundings. The windborne fragrance of a thousand plants as varied as stephanitis, pine, skunk cabbage, lemon, jasmine, grass, but unlike any of them. The heavy, dank odor of vegetation decayed by another world's bacteria, the oak-like musky bass notes of the crushed herbs they lay on overwhelmed their ability to perceive and categorize such things. As three dawns and three dusks came and went, the sounds of the long day changed from chorus to chorus of trilling, shrieking, whirring things. Sometimes they could match the sound to the animal that made it, a shrilling that belonged to the lizard-like creatures they called little green guys, an amazingly loud, rasping noise that was made by a small, scaly biped staking out its territory in the forest's ground litter. Most often, the sounds were full of mystery, as was the god that some of them worshipped.
Remind you of anything you may have heard?
Avatar.
Avatar?
Avatar, yeah.
The god that some of them worshipped? Are we talking about some of them on the planet or some of them in the...
Some of
the earth, earthlings.
They're not all, yeah.
This is... Go ahead.
Garden of Eden.
Yeah. It is like the Garden of Eden. They're naming things. They're understanding what's around them. It's this incredible beauty. There's no worry. There's no defensiveness. You know, they're in a, it's perfection. So of course they have to leave. Let's get out of here. It's perfect and kind of boring. So then they go on to, you know, to. Figure out a way to establish contact because they're fairly certain that this is the planet where the music came. They're certain that this is the planet where the music came from, but they haven't seen any creatures beyond these, you know, the little guys and the Richard Nixons and things. So they're looking for larger creatures that would have created the music. So there's another description where she describes them making contact with creatures. So they've kind of met each other in the clearing. They're looking at each other. Everyone's sort of standing around and trying to figure out what to do. And Emilio, of course, is the one that comes forward and starts talking to one of the children, someone they believe is a child. Soon other children came forward and their parents moved closer as well until the two groups, alien and native, merged, enthralled, surrounding Amelia and Ashkama, which is the name of the what do we call her, a Rakat child, as he made pebbles and leaves and flowers multiply and vanish and reappear because he did magic tricks, gathering possible numbers and nouns and, more important, expressions of surprise and puzzlement and delight, watching Ashkama's face as he worked, glancing at the adults and many other children to check responses, already absorbing the body language and mirroring it in its dance of discovery. Smiling and in love with God and all his works, Emilio at last held out his arms and Ashkama settled happily into his lap, thick muscled tapering tail curling comfortably around her as she nestled down and watched him greet other children and began to learn their names in the tripled sunshine that broke through the clouds. He felt as though he were a prism, gathering up God's love like white light and scattering it in all directions. And the sensation was nearly physical as he caught and repeated as much of what everyone said to him as he could, soaking up the music and cadence, the pattern of phenomes on the fly, gravely accepting and repeating Ashkama's quiet corrections when he got things wrong. So it was a very peaceful meeting between the humans and the people there. They were very welcoming and all of that sort of stuff. And Emilio at that point really does believe that God has sent them to this place. This is a place where they are meant to be. There's nothing to stand in their way. So then what happens?
He sounds like a good missionary as opposed to the last one we discussed.
He doesn't try to baptize anyone.
No. He's learning from them right away.
Soon after they make contact, Alan dies. And I think there's a reason I didn't remember him very well, because he's not in the book very long.
No.
He just dies one day.
It's very mysterious and unsolved.
So Anne, who is a doctor, does an autopsy to see if there was some infection, if he had a disease, if there was nothing. He's gone. He actually dies before they make contact, I think, with the mm-hmm. with the people, right? Because they have to leave his grave behind.
I think it's soon after the section I just read.
Okay.
They don't even have very long a planet before they lose one of them.
Yeah, that's true. And he was well and healthy and just died. Didn't wake up. So they keep going. They keep making inroads, learn the language. All of them learn language, and depending on their specialty, they learn other things. You know, they learn medical things, anthropological things. They learn about, you know, how their family systems work. It takes them a long time to figure out that the men are smaller and the women are bigger mm-hmm. in this group of people, and that children are treated differently than human children. I mean, they're loved and everything, but they're just assumptions that we make about family systems really had to go out the window, because they kind of came into it with ideas that of, you know, who would be the hunter and who would be the child giver. Pregnancy is very short, and then the fathers pretty much raise the babies, and just some, you know, things like that they could have never known without witnessing it. So while you're reading all this, I mean, what are you thinking about the larger themes? You know, this is, you know, it's a narrative that can carry along, but the larger themes, if this is a novel that's about faith or about mission or about, you know, outreach to others, you know, at this point in the story, kind of in the first half of the story, we're all good, right? Things are going great, pretty much.
Well, yeah. We know something, because they're trying to set, in the Naples scenes, they're trying to set up Emilio for a trial within the Jesuits, mm-hmm. and he has to be guarded, mm-hmm. kept from public view, because whatever happened has caused a lot of scandal.
Right. So you're right, the way you said it, I thought, was you do read the book with this sense of dread. Mm-hmm. And there's part of me, and then as you watch them or you read about them, having such a positive beginning, you think how, for me it was to think how easy it is for us to be naive.
Yeah.
and to walk in as strangers and really not understand what a culture is. It's so hard to be a stranger and really figure out what's going on. So it's so easy to do.
Well, we
the
find
image, do things that are wrong.
Well, because one significant piece is the language of the song they've not yet encountered on the planet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're with this species, but who are the people who sing the song? And that becomes crucial.
And remember, what they do ultimately find out is that they're two different species. It's like zebras and lions. So they've met the zebras, who are great, you know. How nice could zebras be? They're helping us out, and they're giving us plants to eat and all of this stuff. But the lions are the ones that have made the music, who they haven't met yet. So,
but they're on the right planet.
Right.
They are on the right planet.
They're on the right planet. Meanwhile, you find out kind of this other stuff about the species that lives in the cities, basically. And they are carnivores, which is a pretty important thing that comes out later. And the people that they're with at first are vegetarians. So what's the other thing? I'm wondering, Karen, if you're thinking about the same thing as I am about the thoughtless thing that the humans do, or this...
Well, the big turning point mistake is planting a garden.
Right. And why is that?
Because it changes the balance of everything. I mean, they're initially thinking of themselves having some familiar foods, mm-hmm. and it's helpful because they can see that the people they're with are benefiting because they're growing physically healthier and stronger. Their diet is.
And they won't impose on their host so much. We won't take all their food. We'll grow our own food.
Provide for themselves.
So the people around them say, well, this is cool, and then you have all this food to eat. So they start planting gardens too. As a result of that, they start breeding more. They start having more babies, which totally upsets the apple cart. At that point, they are not... they're not supposed to be in the business of having a lot of children. They are not, it's really a contained society. They are really overseen by the people in the city, the lions, as I was referring
and
to.
And then other villages also plant gardens, mm-hmm. and so it's spreading.
Mm-hmm. That kind of goes.
They were there quite a while then.
Years,
yeah.
I think it's 2 years before they get to the city.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, because one guy postpones it about a year. They heard about the city, and it takes them a year before they can get there.
Their leader postpones it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, another important thing happens about this time. This is what always happens in movies. They use up fuel in their lander. It's kind of a capsule. They use it because of an accident. A couple things happen, and then they realize all at once they won't be able to leave. So now they're there. They're on Rakat forever. There's no way for them to get back home. Which they take with amazing good grace,
yeah.
I think. They were like, oh, well, you know.
But
we have...
for the most part, they're people who don't have strong attachments. Mm-hmm. The people they care most about, they're with.
Yeah.
And also, so far, things have been pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. There's no reason to think they couldn't just live the rest of their days there happily. And
they still
and
have a connection to the spaceship.
They send reports back.
Still sending reports
back. Yeah, sending reports back. Jimmy and Sophia fall in love and get married, and Sophia's expecting a baby. You know, it's really kind of coming along. Things are going along great. So, do you think that we're going to make contact with extraterrestrials pretty soon, within our lifetime? Not in your lifetime, Norma, okay.
Yeah, I toy with the idea we already have over the millennia mm-hmm. that we have had contact. Mm-hmm. And we're all made of stardust, so, you know, we came from out there somewhere, too.
Mm-hmm. For the last 5 years, the Arizona Phoenix area has hosted the UFO conference, which brings in people internationally.
Uh-huh.
And if you just sit and listen to people there for 3 to 5 days, mm-hmm. you will
have witnessed all kinds of encounters, and they have groups that go up to Sedona and meet. So it's sort of common knowledge with that group.
Yeah, and there certainly are people that, you know, well-known educated people that believe that it's already happening, it's, you know, something that's ongoing. So maybe what I should say is, do we believe that it will be more widely believed than it is now? Contact Ron.
I think there's life all over the universe, but I don't personally think we'll ever make contact because of the distances. Mm-hmm. The nearest star is 4.2 light years away. Mm-hmm. It took 3 days to get to the moon. At those speeds, to get to that nearest star, it would take 800,000 years. Mm-hmm. And if it could go 100 times faster, it would still take 8,000 years. Mm-hmm. And that's to the nearest star, and they don't think there's any planets around there that have light. And then to the next nearest would be another 800,000 years. Mm-hmm. So.
But they can come here.
Well, they would have the same distances.
Different travel. So it started 8,000 years ago.
Yeah. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the physicist, I don't know if you've heard of him or not, he leads the Hayden Planetarium. Mm-hmm. And he believes that it will happen. And he said, you know, that the difference between humans and apes is only a 2% difference. But he said that 2% difference is the difference, is a huge, huge difference. You know, it's language. And he said if there are civilizations that are 2% smarter than we are, they will bypass that. If you can think of it, so that we're not really smart enough to envision another a more sophisticated community, because we're so finite as an ape would be thinking about playing a game of pool.
The thing is, if they come here, we would be Rakat if we look at the story. And they would be the people with the technology and all the expertise and the advanced. I mean, they would. So it's interesting. I wondered, what exactly would they think of us?
The crew, as much as they were welcomed, they thought they were kind of boring.
Yeah.
And you know, they were nice enough, but they, you know, were kind of simple.
Yeah, the people that they lived among at the beginning. Yeah, they were kind of childlike or, you know.
Not very sophisticated and boring and simple, but nice.
Right.
That kind of makes you think, where would other people land? What they would think, you know, like if you land in the Midwest, maybe it'd be different than landing in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. The experience of, or if you landed in Botswana or in New York. Mm-hmm. To make that judgment about what people are.
So this also leads us to the question: if we believe God created the heavens and the earth, God created the earth, God created us. So, you know, God kind of likes us the best, right? I mean, aren't we the first? You know, aren't we kind of the first in line? Aren't we the most favored? So if someone outside of our personal experience does show up. I mean, wait a minute, what does that do with my ranking? And what does that do with our ideas of our history, our Bible, our pecking order, you know, all of that stuff? What does that do to our foundational beliefs about what a human is or what a child of God is?
I think it would have a similar impact as when Copernicus said that the Earth was not the center of the solar system or the center of the universe. I think that would be really difficult for him, theologically, for an awful lot of people.
Heretical, perhaps.
In the movie Contact, which is a different story, there's a Christian group that actually tries to blow up the machine. they're using to try and contact the aliens that have contacted people on Earth, because it's just too dangerous for them.
And is it seen as outside of God's plan or something to make contact, or?
Well, part of the technology that the aliens send, there's information that's beyond human comprehension, but it's scary because there's a species that's more intelligent than us out there. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of it in that story.
Mm-hmm. So we know from the beginning that Emilio is accused of two crimes. He's accused of being a prostitute, and he's accused of killing a child. And when the UN shuttle comes to pick him up, they witness him kill a child. So they know that that is true. And so throughout the story, then we find out that that's actually the little girl that he first made contact with, his little sister, basically, someone who was with him and who he loved a great deal. And throughout the course of the story, we kind of find out, you know, what it was that happened with that. So all the way through, most of the way through, Emilio is called things like a living saint. He's considered to be a mystic, to be very close to God, and has this belief that, you know, God has called him on this mission. All of this is for a reason, and he's been brought there for a purpose. So what happens to cause all this to sort of disintegrate? What's going on with these themes, with these characters?
Well, for Emilio, what I say is like giving things away. I mean, it's really incredibly awful things happen to him. And his commitment all along is that he's in God's hands. Mm-hmm. And if he's in God's hands, how could these terrible, awful things happen to him? And it becomes a huge struggle. And is that God's will? Was he brought there so that those awful things could happen to him?
An interesting thing about the author is that she was born and baptized Roman Catholic and became an atheist, she said, at age 15. And then 20 years later or so, she had a child and decided that her ethics were based in religious foundations, and so she converted to Judaism. So she's Jewish. She also believes that Emilio's experiences were like a micro-Holocaust. A very small Holocaust. But that made sense to me when I started to think about it. People thrown into terrible circumstances, losing the people they love, losing, it seems like losing the love of God, losing justice, losing anything that would make sense. And Emilio is the survivor to be able to tell that story.
And I can't remember exactly now, because it's been a while I've read it, but one of his phrases that once maybe during the trial is, it is true and it's not true at all.
Right.
And which turns out to be an accurate sort of thing mm-hmm. for him to say. That, mm-hmm. And how complicated stories get to be sometimes, or events get to be, that we like simple answers, this is right, that's mm-hmm. wrong, and that it was accurate for him to say,
this is what happened, but that's not the truth. Or he
right.
says something like that.
That is,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and I remember for me, because early on we know that it's the child that he's in close relationship with that he kills. And so in my mind, I'm thinking of all kinds of reasons why he maybe would have done that. Mm-hmm.
To protect her from something.
You know,
or
yeah. And it was completely, when it finally came out, mm-hmm. why he killed her, it was completely not on my radar.
In the novel?
In the novel. Because all the other problems are caused by Big Prince.
Yeah.
Not understanding what they're looking at, not understanding what's happening. They're making choices without thinking of the consequences, but always done with the best of intentions. It's kind of like, the thing that sold me on this novel is the prologue, where you have this story about they uncover these signals, and while the world debated, you know, at the UN, Jesuits just sold a bunch of stuff and built a spaceship and went. Without telling anyone. They just go. Mm-hmm. But then it ends with, they meant no harm. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's true. They didn't mean any harm.
I think there's a great deal of hubris in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
lot of areas.
It seems like that's what the novel is about to me.
Yeah. And Emilio is a very proud, he's constantly compared to a conquistador or a Spanish hidalgo, kind of machismo.
Exceedingly bright. And very much depends on his intellect. You know, his intellect has taken him very far. He's brilliant. But he's proud. Damaged.
Do you think it says something about, I don't mean this in a diminishing way, but it's hesitate to even say it, but it seems like, at least where I live, that the Catholic Church owns the most beautiful property. It's expensive, it's beautiful, it's you know, it's prime, it's choice, and it seems like wanting to go to outer space is like a further need for acquisition to get to the most, to own the most beautiful place again.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like he's kind of entrapped in that, model of, in the name of God, we can acquire. And I know that sounds a little not nice, but.
Mm-hmm.
Well, historically speaking, it's very true.
Well, it's selling beautiful artwork that funds them being, I mean, it's these valuable works of art that are sold to fund this mission.
And exploitation. Not that that's unique to, I mean, that's the whole idea of mission is hubris and acquisition for me in many ways.
Say some more about that. So mission, the idea of mission is hubris?
To believe that to be evangelical is to believe that we have a handle on truth, and that it there is a fellow that has talked about possibilism, and I forget what his name is, but his thing is that you to be either atheist or to be very religious is to really to be arrogant that you believe the truth, that we believe the truth, but that there's so many possibilities, and that a really expansive God is to say that there's more possibilities and more possibilities and more possibilities and more possibilities. That when we go out to be evangelical, it is because we believe we have that truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly got him in trouble here.
Mm-hmm. So do you think God didn't really have anything to do with this whole fiasco?
Well, I'm sure in the Holocaust there was a question, where is God? And the truth, but really the question was, where is man?
Mm-hmm.
Though I count this book among fiction that I think really bears witness to theology of the cross, God being most present where God seems most absent. It reminded me of Silence by Shisako Endo in that regard, which is also a very haunting tale. And, you know, at the beginning it just looks crystal clear, and then the more you learn, the more you learn, the more you learn, the more, I use the word mesmerized or captivated, you are. And then discover that love and truth defy that. I think what you say about the Catholic Church is quite plausible. I also think there's an implicit critique of intellect in this. Because the Jesuits are so known for their intellectual gifts and strengths.
And that sometimes the arrogance of our science, too, to say that we can somehow understand and control then the world as we if we understand it properly, and then, you know, we have power over it.
Well, and technology too, so
that's
another piece of this.
If we just have enough information, we'll know everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they gathered a whole lot of information. They still don't know why Alan died, and they, you know, and then Anne, who is pragmatic and not a believer, says, well, God killed him. I mean, she couldn't explain why he died, so she gets, you know, she's angry that he's died, and she says, you know, people say thank God when the surgery goes well, but if the surgery doesn't go well, then you blame the surgeon. And I'm just here to say, I don't know why he died. Let's blame God. You know, so, you know, sometimes you can kind of, you can flip it on your ear. You know, when do you choose to say, well, it was God's hand, or, you know, when do you say it wasn't? And, you know, where does it all, what does it all mean? Where does it all lead? But I believe until the end, Sandoz, Emilio believed that they, that God wanted them to go. There was a purpose for them to go. They were directed to go. The author says, I wanted readers to look philosophically at the idea that you can be seduced by the notion that God is leading you and that your actions have his approval. So what do you think about that, and what do you think she means by that, and in what way was Emilio seduced by this notion, do you think?
Seems like the belief of God in some way stops all rational thought. That to say God just wanted him dead was to stop this, the search for what really was happening. Mm-hmm. It's a just a giving up.
Mm-hmm.
It could, maybe it looked like an act of faith, but in some ways it was, I've reached the place of my intellectual capacity, and so we'll just say it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, part of what's troubling for me is because he really, right before this, the most awful things happen to him, he has the sense of, oh, that something good is going to come of it. And he envisions what that good thing is going to be, because he cannot envision the awful stuff that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't even enter the scope of his imagination. And he's, you know, naive enough to think that, that oh, this is going to lead to a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes just a living hell.
Mm-hmm.
I think the word haunting is such a really, that's really, when I think back, that's the word I would have said, haunting. It haunted me so much after I read this book. I didn't read books for several months. I didn't want to.
Have you read Children of God?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't read science fiction. There's
mm-hmm.
a reason. I seduced is such a good word.
Mm-hmm.
I get seduced into it, and it was haunting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, I just read magazines for months.
Sometimes you do have to cleanse the palate with a magazine.
For me, I think it's the thing that Anne says the most directly, the section you just referenced, that it keeps coming back. Different characters keep coming back to that. If God had intended this to happen over here, then clearly God must have intended all this other stuff to happen too. So, and trying to sort out what
mm-hmm.
that means. Where, you know, Sophia Mendes, where was God when my parents were killed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of the other, I think this is the right way it happens. One of the other characters says, God was there weeping.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean anything to her. That's not
yeah.
satisfying for her.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that begs the same old question. Does everything that happens, is that what God intends?
Yeah. And what is the nature of God?
Right.
Is the nature of God that he's observant of all the details, that he really does have his hand on the throttle all the time, or that he's
the clock maker?
Yeah.
Sits back.
Yeah. Winds it up
well,
and lets
what
it go.
Is the nature of power?
Mm-hmm.
Or human will?
Yeah.
Free will.
I think when I tend to think of creatures outside of our universe, I do tend to have this sort of idealized idea of, if they're going to be more advanced than us, well, obviously they would not be manipulating each other or doing terrible things to the other creatures. And it's like, well, this pretty much disabuses me of that idea, because they're just as horrible as we are. You know, they're horrible. And maybe that's another way to think about it. I mean, if we bring to them news of a God that's less horrible, maybe that is what we're supposed to do. You know, we don't always do such a great job of following God, but, you know, maybe we can talk about that God.
If this is a diversion, just ignore it, but is her book about World War II called Threads of Grace?
Thread of Grace, yes.
Yeah, have you read that?
I've got about half of it read.
Yeah. Has anybody else read that?
I have not.
It's also very well written, and I found it powerful and captivating too, but it's like this book in that it's extremely complex. And, you know, it starts out typical World War II book where the good guys and bad guys, but by the end, there you see redemptive sides of real scoundrels, and you know some of the there are no saints unscathed, put it that way. Everybody is complicit in this web of it's. I would recommend reading it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a book I always recommend.
Is it a novel?
It is.
And
yeah,
okay.
It's a novel.
What about Children of God? What's that one about?
It's the sequel.
So he's back on that planet again. Right, Emilio goes back. Okay, we probably shouldn't say anymore. Yeah, well, I already blabbed about one thing. Well, we know at the end of the book Emilio is asked to go back, so
they're planning a mission to return to Rakat.
It's a really interesting question to ask people who've read the book which they like best, and I think it's quite revealing.
Which one did you like best?
I like the sparrow better.
I like the sparrow better.
I forget how he gets back.
I like the way they fit together.
What a politician.
I can't. Once I've read the second one, I can't really say that it's... Because my knowledge of the second one affects how I see things from the first one.
Well, that's true.
It's sort of like... the Matrix movies. When it was just one Matrix movie, the movie meant one thing, and you added the other two.
Yeah. Same with Star Wars.
I can't watch the first Matrix movie anymore without that all being messed up.
Well, and I think I was so anxious to find out what happened in Children of God, I really zipped through it, and I really don't remember very much about it. I remember just finishing it and thinking, well, I finished it, but I don't like it as well as The Sparrow. But I should go back and reread that one.
My sense of Children of God, I hope this doesn't give anything away, is that it tidies up some of these haunting questions. That the sparrow is much more open-ended about the depth of these questions, and there is some resolution of it. Like that, I guess I could say now.
Going back to what you know, where
to be afraid of it.
Yeah, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Yeah, and it does kind of tie up the loose ends. I think that's a good way to put it. Going back to kind of towards the end of the book, when Emilio is finally, you know, sort of confessed everything or spoken the words that he needed to speak, he says to the one of the inquisitors, "Do you think so, John? Was it your God?" he asked with terrifying gentleness. "You see, that is my dilemma. Because if I was led by God to love God step by step, as it seemed, if I accept that the beauty and the rapture were real and true, then the rest of it was God's will too. And that, gentlemen, is cause for bitterness. But if I am simply a deluded ape who took a lot of old folk tales far too seriously, then I brought all this on myself and my companions, and the whole business becomes farcical, doesn't it? The problem with atheism, I find, under these circumstances," he continued with academic exactitude, each word etched on the air with acid, "is that I have no one to despise but myself. If, however, I choose to believe that God is vicious, then at least I have the solace of hating God." Looking from face to face, he watched comprehension working its way into their minds. What could any of them say? He almost laughed. "Can you guess what I thought just before I was used the first time?" he asked them as he began to pace. "This is rich. This is very funny. You see, I was scared, but I didn't understand what was going on. I never imagined. Who could have imagined such a thing? I am in God's hands, I thought. I loved God, and I trusted in his love. Amusing, isn't it? I laid down all my defenses. I had nothing between me and what happened but the love of God. And I was raped. I was naked before God, and I was raped." And he's punished when he comes back by others, and he's punished he punishes himself. And of course, the child who he loved very much. But he was also at the end of his, at the end of anyone's rope. I mean, he was, he could hardly, he did it, but he would, could hardly be blamed for killing the child because he was in extreme, extreme situation, I think.
One character that I really appreciated seeing the transformation of was the one priest, Walter, really just despised him and thought the worst of him and really came to see and understand who this man was before him. And towards the end too is the one actually gives voice to some of the insights to name things.
And what's interesting is that it's not an indictment against organized religion, I don't think. It isn't a diss of organized religion. I think it's she shows a lot of insight. I mean, a lot of clear-eyed insight, but it's not, and then we should just throw it all out because there's no good in it, there's no use to it, there's no function for it.
It's more of a critique of faith. The kind of scandal of faith, of persisting in belief, kind of against all odds.
So was God calling them to Rakat? Was God calling them to Rakat?
I haven't read the book.
It's all right.
I mean, haven't you felt sort of compelled in some way at some point in your life? But the question is that God or is it something else? My DNA? Is it just something that out there that's triggered something in me that it now is stirring so much that I have to, I'm restless and unless I keep pursuing it. To not pursue those things when you're stirring isn't the answer. To pursue them and to think, well, it must be God, that must not, I don't think that's the answer either. You sort of go out not knowing, have the courage to pursue them and hope maybe God is involved in it, but we do hope we have to keep some humility about that.
I was just thinking about, actually, when we decided to get married, I didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, I didn't know, but I thought, well, I think I will get married to Glenn. And I mean, you have some information and you have a gut feel and you think, well, I hope God will bless us and God has, but you don't know how it's going to turn out, and I have other friends where it has not gone nearly as well. So should nobody ever get married because maybe it'll go badly?
This mission is just an incredible fit for their talents and abilities. They are so gifted for these particular skills, and then when they are there on the planet, you see, them bringing out the best in life.
Well, it's the Garden of Eden. I mean, really? They all complement each other beautifully.
I think what David said about it reading like a Greek tragedy is right on. I agree with that completely. And I think reading those helps us have language when we face tragedy. Mm-hmm. You know, we work at the same college, and we had a young alum, I suppose that's getting to be 5 or 6 years ago, had been a Bible camp counselor in Idaho and now was a youth director in Salt Lake City and went back to Idaho and went on a solo hike and climbed one of these tall Sawbill Mountains and signed a book at the top and then was never seen again. And then, you know, and he wrote something like, magnificent height, to God be the glory for this awesome beauty. And then they found his body about 15 months later. His dad has now written a book about it. But, you know, I know we say he shouldn't have walked alone. The president of our college now has a rule that nobody hikes alone. So we took all these pictures of us together.
See, Rob, we had a group of five.
Yeah. You don't wish him not to love the mountains and not to hike. I mean, even though it...
His parents probably wished he hadn't have gone that day.
Yeah.
You know, if he hadn't have gone that day.
Whatever.
But you wouldn't have wished him not to ever step outside.
My father drowned in a really tragic ice fishing accident. And, you know, for a long time it was hard to love water again. But he was doing what he loved, and he had given me this love of the outdoors. And I think these stories help us with those kinds of things for which you don't have language. So even, you know, it's a call in one way, but it's a call to tragedy in the other. That's why I think it's a theology of the cross.
You know, I know that probably your president making that rule was, you know, because it's buck stops with him, but that always makes me laugh. You're adults. You know, that what he really said, what do you mean, much better they use good judgment rather than you can't hike alone?
Well, but good judgment is don't hike alone.
Make a law about
it. No, he's expressing his
frustration.
Yeah.
But I think that response is almost,
well, it's like after your child is hurt, then you say, you always hold hands when we cross the street. I mean, you hold on to people tighter after something bad has happened, I think.
Just continuing on this thing of feeling compelled and stirred in a direction, is there a difference between doing that one way, and I suppose someone like Hitler felt stirred and compelled to go in a direction. Is there a, I don't know, what's the difference? I think there is a difference. Maybe it has something to do with self-awareness and self-delusion and those kind of things.
Well, and discernment. I mean, it's so hard.
Yeah.
I think about, I can't remember exactly the words, but where Abraham Lincoln at some point says, both sides pray to the same God, and neither's prayers will be completely answered. I mean, that's a...
Well, it's easier when you're young, and it is, you know, a comic book. And there's the good guys and the bad guys. I mean, there's something very comforting about that.
Right.
But the older you get and the more you read, reading is power.
And the more mistakes we make.
And the more mistakes you make in your own life,
yeah,
or you see others make, I think that the harder it is to think too little of others, or to not understand there's probably more to it than what appears. You know, Adolf Hitler was somebody's son.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus died for Adolf Hitler, too.
I think the black and white is so much easier to deal with.
Oh, yeah.
But black seems to be in shades of gray.
Yeah. I agree.
And strengths are our
weakness.
I mean,
or whatever variation there is.
I think one of the strengths of the novel is that it gives us yet another way to kind of ask these questions and debate this issue of faith, but it doesn't really answer it. It doesn't really come down and say, and there are, what I think is very interesting for both novels, is there are no villains.
Not really.
Maybe like what you were describing in the World War II novel. It's like, there are people who do bad things, but there are no bad people in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
My character I like the most is actually Supari Ogaijor, one of the carnivores.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of ways his life evolves and decisions he makes. And again, making the best possible decision at the time, and turns out later that was a terrible mistake.
Yeah. But the cultural norms that they describe through him, you know, if you were, what your birth order was,
yeah,
and whether or not you're able to have children, or
yeah,
or if you could do certain things. I mean, it's a very prescribed culture that, again, we just assume, you know, we understand culture, we know how it goes. If you're, and they had this whole reversal of a lot of different kinds of roles and expectations, which kind of shows her creativity too, I think, kind of turned the world on its ear.
You should probably tell us, Jan, that tomorrow's novel is as delightful.
That's right. That's right.
I, people come to
well,
you.
I know. And now, so you can feel really bad about more things. And it's a novel. It's actually a novel about aging, but it has a great deal of humor and hope. And John Hassler, if you are not familiar with him, is a recently deceased but great treasure of Minnesota, state of Minnesota. He was a writer in residence at St. John's University. He is a practicing Catholic till the end of his days, and there's always a wonderful kind of Catholic flavor in his novels. So Simon's Night, if you haven't read it, I would still encourage you to come tomorrow because we're going to read some excerpts that I think will delight you and give us great encouragement. So thanks, everybody, for coming.